Hey guys, today we're going to be talking about the ED and the ICU. And one topic that both of those areas are really interested in is hemorrhagic shock and massive transfusion. And if that interests you, we have some more material on that over in the Intensive Care Academy. That's our other program at ICU101.com. We just dropped a big lesson on how to run an MTP, how to transfuse, all the logistics for dealing with massive hemorrhagic shock. Really appropriate to anyone in the SICU, in the ED who sees big bleeders, trauma patients, GI bleeds, anything like that. Check it out at ICU101.com. See you soon. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Hello everyone, it is Brandon back here with Brian.
Hey everybody.
And we're going to have some chat today about one of our favorite practical topics, which is sort of understanding the relationship and interface and overlap and sometimes conflict between different groups and specialties and roles. And one of the most common and important interfaces we ever have in the ICU is with the emergency department. EM is sort of a sibling specialty, you might say, to critical care in a lot of ways, and that we care about a lot of the same things, but we see patients at very different phases in their care. And of course, often sequentially. A lot of the patients we see in the ICU and almost any type of ICU came via the ED. And that means that there's a lot of opportunities for us to optimize how we take care of the same patients and to understand each other, or frankly, to misunderstand each other, which is also probably common. But the best person to understand that is someone who lives in both worlds. So we have here Dr. Namita Jayaprakash, who is both critical care trained as well as emergency medicine and the medical director for her ICU. And she's going to help us kind of get a look behind this curtain. Again, we're sort of blessed that there are people with this type of dual training versus just, you know, having to come at this independently from the two sides of it. But welcome, Namita.
Thank you.
Yeah, so this idea kind of grew out of a conversation Namita and I had at SCCM, the Congress, a couple months ago. you know, I started out as an ER nurse and would frequently get frustrated with the ICU when, you know, we had patients who were down in the ED who needed to come up to the ICU. And there was a bed available, but the IC would say, well, they're not parable. We can't work them in because of staffing and, you know, all this stuff. And in the ED, we just felt like you guys just clearly don't understand what's going on down here. And this patient needs to go to the ICU. And when I became an ICU nurse, it was like, oh, because I started to understand from their side of things, you know, why, you know, what does that mean? Patient's not parable. Oh, I get it now, right? Because up in the IC, we're not necessarily just doing those things that they're doing in the ED. And then I would realize there's a whole different set of frustrations upstairs with the nurses and the providers who would say, you know, well, I don't understand why the ED can't do X, or why, you know, I have to go down and hold their hand over these things or whatever. What are they, a bunch of idiots? And I would go, well, no, they're not idiots. I've been down there. I used to work down there. And so, yeah, we started talking at SCCM and thought, this is a good conversation we should share with other people because, unfortunately, not all of us have worked both sides of the coin. So, Namita, what do you think is the biggest problem when it comes to, I guess, misunderstanding between the ED and the ICU?
All right, that's a great question. So I have not only am I an EM intensivist, so I'm the medical director of the emergency department, and within the emergency department where I work, we are growing out a EDICU space. So it's sort of the total continuum. And so in the role of medical director, I often get the, I want to say complaints, but the next day feedback of this didn't go well, or this didn't happen exactly as it was designed. And so I think, many of the roots I often wonder is whether or not we do a great job of pausing and thinking about the other person's role. I think, Brian, you described that really well as you reflected on your career as having started out in the emergency department and then going over to the ICU and realizing that the perspectives are different because the lived experiences are different. And so I would say that the first thing is getting stuck in your own little world and not pausing enough to understand what's going on the other side. It's so easy within medicine, within the different specialties, that if to start to feel very siloed. Is it, this is what I'm doing. This is what's in front of me, but it's not as easy to pause and look up and going, oh, did this happen because X, Y, Z was going on. So I think we go into work, we all have the best of intentions, but your day does not often pan out that way, especially in the emergency department where there is no pop-off valve, really. Like, the doors don't close. There's federal mandates that say that we have to deal with everything that comes through the emergency department. So there's no stop. And so even if you wanted to do a perfect, 100% ideal evaluation, tee everything up, the 5-10 other competing demands get in the way. And so oftentimes, I find as I'm calling up report, I am calling up report because I have 2 seconds before the next resuscitation comes in. Now on the ICU side, as I'm receiving a report, it's also sometimes I'm receiving the report as I'm getting called in many different directions, but neither people know what the other person is doing because you're often doing it across the phone. You're not, and so the visual cues are not there. And so something, sometimes I do wonder if the misunderstandings really are deep rooted in a lack of awareness of the different silos and the fact that there are silos to begin with.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because I can think back to when I worked in the emergency department, and I worked in a level one trauma center, big academic medical center. So we got a lot of patients transferred from smaller outlying facilities. And a lot of the things that I hear the ICU say about the ED within our own hospital are the same sort of things that we said about the outlying EDs, right? Like why didn't this trauma get appropriately worked up before coming to us? Right? EMS brings them somebody because they're 2 minutes down the road from a big MVC, and they come up and they haven't had a thorough trauma evaluation. What kind of janky ER is this, right? Without understanding that it's probably an ER that has one provider and 3 or 4 nurses, and they've just been hit with something that at the level one trauma center up the road is going to have 5 or 6 providers and 15 nurses attack it. And so I think you make a good point, right? Not understanding the other person's point of view, and it goes kind of both ways.
Well, Brian, what this reminds me of, when we recently spoke with Kwame Boateng about global health and practicing internationally, and how so much of the comparison between those settings is not really obviously the humans are the same and a lot of the diseases are the same, but the environments and the challenges are so different. And I think here it comes up in the sense of priorities and triage. Right, you may be looking at a patient, let's say in the ICU, and saying, "Why can't they control this patient's blood pressure more tightly when they have a bleed or something?" And not realizing down there, there's like 3 codes going on or something like that. So like the people down there would say that would be nice, but in the scheme of what we have to deal with, it's not the highest priority. Whereas in your frankly more controlled environment, that might be your highest priority. That sort of thing.
Yeah, it's so true, Brandon. That's exactly the thought I have, because I, as somebody who works in both environments, and I'm on an ICU week, it feels so much more controlled. And then I'm back in the emergency department, and that sense of chaos is just significantly higher.
It seems like it would create a challenge trying to create an overlapping space like an EDICU where it's like a mode switch almost. It's like, how do you carve out a space of more control within a realm of chaos?
It's a great question as well. And I think it's a great point, because I am somebody that I think my brain, it's interesting. I've noticed that when I work in the ICU versus the emergency department, my processing actually is very different. And so when I work as in EM intensivist whether it's a consult shift or in that longitudinal space, so it's a continuum of the patient's journey. So patient arrives, emergency department resuscitation stabilization. Then you're boarding, waiting for the ICU. So that's often the EM critical care, like that ED ICU interface space. And those could be either a personal focused model where it's consults or transitioning into a geographic space. So when I'm working in the in-between, and if it's like I've worked in the personnel focused models where you're going down and consulting, and I actually find it really hard to think about longitudinal critical care in the chaos of an emergency department setting. Same person, same knowledge base, but the needs of how I need to think about it and the environment around it is really difficult. But when I work in that same environment and I know it's a standard EM shift, brain can handle it. Moving into, I need to think about it in the ICU space, brain gets overwhelmed and oftentimes I have to walk away so I can process. And so there's a very real issue with that, like the geographic setting, the phase of illness, the competing demands, and how much can a human brain really handle. And that's the appreciation that if you're not working in that specialty, it's not as obvious and upfront.
That's an interesting point, because I think a lot of times we assume that the problem is knowledge, and not necessarily in a pejorative way, not necessarily I'm saying like EM providers are not as smart as ICU providers, but I think we think of it as they're just trained differently, right? They're trained for a different focus. They're trained for resuscitation and rapid triage, not necessarily, like you said, long-term critical care. And, you know, the whole inch deep and a mile wide versus depth, we see this a lot in specialty, right? We, you know, the neuro ICU patient that's boarding in the ED who's not getting, you know, the sort of the specialty neuro checks or the tight blood pressure control, because we go, well, they just don't get how important that is. But this is a different perspective. What you're saying is that it's not necessarily that they don't get it or that they don't know. It's that it's literally a different... a different thought process, maybe, because of the different environment?
It's not necessarily a thought process. I mean, it's, yes, the environment. The environment, even if you take the intensivists and put them in the environment, they can't handle it because of the environment. But I would actually argue the nature of needing to have a patient in the emergency department beyond the decision to admit to the ICU is the nature of access block to the ICU because our healthcare systems are strained. And so you're right. It's not the specialty that should be caring for the longitudinal critical care needs. But as a result of the strains of the healthcare system, the expectation is that the emergency department team should function like an ICU. So there's a scope creep that happens because the system around the hospital is under strain. But the scope creep is happening in emergency medicine, which is opening us as emergency department physicians, nurses, APPs, opening us up to the criticism of other specialties who are sitting there and go and wondering, is it a knowledge deficit? Is it a, they can't be bothered or they can't care? So yes, there's the environment that is limiting to be able to have that extensive thought process. But then there is this system is breaking down. And so we have boarding because the system's broken, and now somebody has to step up, and it's being forced on the emergency department side, and then everybody else is critiquing the management per se. So it's like it's really multifactorial. So I think cognitive strain and understanding and appreciating that there are competing demands on the emergency department phase of illness, because you've got a continuous onslaught of patients and depending on how the emergency department operations are set up, it might not be a concentration of high acuity patients. You could have a physician, a provider who is dealing with a critically ill patient alongside a broken bone or a stubbed toe. So each emergency department, the operations are going to look different. And so those are very real competing demands that are going to put a strain on the human brain because you're having to flip back and forth. And then you add on, adding on the expectation of everything should be beautifully managed, there might be knowledge gaps because that's an ask beyond the scope of emergency medicine. But there could also be a, say, in my case, an EM intensivist. So it's not necessarily knowledge gaps. It's just the inability to process and deliver the care because of the environment, but competing demands. So it's very complex and very multifactorial.
I mean, you're so right, because the fact that we're able to have this controlled setting in the ICU and have, quote, deep thoughts is solely because the ED is protecting us from the other patients. I mean, if people could just walk into the ICU, we would not have this like peaceful experience to cogitate upon hyponatremia. And it's like, I was just thinking that in terms of environments, I'll sometimes be at home and I have our two young kids bouncing around and I'll be like, oh, I should try to do some kind of task, solve some problem, some project or something. And then I'll realize 2 minutes in, this is not a problem I can solve with the kids here. Like I just literally don't have the bandwidth to be like holding one and like holding a screwdriver or something like that. And that's like literally what they're doing in the ED. So like some things are just not suited to that type of problem solving and thinking in that space. You need to go somewhere that is, for lack of a better word, quieter.
Yeah. So I was just thinking when you were talking too about competing demands and things like that. I remember one of the first jobs I had as a nurse, I worked in a community hospital and I worked in a cardiothoracic ICU, and I worked at night, and you could tell based on who the house supervisor was, right? The nurse that sort of controls patient flow throughout the whole hospital, who was on, you could kind of know what the night was going to look like, because we had one who was a former ER nurse, and if he was on, you were going to fill up every empty bed you had, because in his mind, the number one priority of the hospital was to decompress the ED. Like you said, because the doors are open and more people are going to come in. So if there's any empty beds in the hospital, they should always be in the ED. There was another one who, she was a former surgical ICU nurse. And so her priority was, hey, there are cases tomorrow that will need ED beds, or that will need ICU beds afterwards. And so if we've got three empty beds in the surgical ICU, I'm going to keep them. I'm going to hold on to them and board people in the ED, because those scheduled cases are going to need those beds tomorrow. Both of which I think are equally valid points, just coming at it from a different point of view.
Yeah, I often wonder, Brian, if we all just did like walk in a day of my life, how different those approaches might end up being. And I don't know, because I think there is so much truth to the fact that there are different lived experiences in healthcare. And so what you take into leadership roles or supervisory roles or bed assignment roles are influenced by what was your path before.
Yeah. So let's talk about a little bit about, so what do we do about it, right? Because we can sit here all day and talk about how it's a problem. We all know it's a problem. And we can talk about why it's a problem. And we could all be more sympathetic. But at the end of the day, it's still a problem. So how can we be beyond just saying, hey, think about other people and be sympathetic to their problems. What can we do? So you mentioned that you get a lot of, as the medical director, you get a lot of these complaints about things that are going wrong. So from your standpoint, what are the biggest complaints that the ICU has about the ED and vice versa?
You know, I've find it's more like the buckets of a process designed in the ED-ICU interface of a hospital didn't go as it should be designed, or as it was designed. That seems so. A report wasn't called up, and the patient showed up, this was the wrong ICU, and it. I guess it's hard, and mainly because I've moved institutions, so processes are different, and so it's hard to really go, what was the number one complaint? Because depending on what your hospital procedures, policies, and such, it could look different. So I think the buckets, though, are often the handoff space or deviation from an expected process. And so I think the handoff space is a challenge, despite all of the interventions and our knowledge and the importance everyone acknowledges and understands the importance of handoff, how it happens is often not as ideal as we design and we drill and we train, and whether it's acronyms like IPASS or other acronyms, we all know that the handoffs don't often, the giver and the receiver don't always get the same information despite our best designs. And I've worked in institutions where there's electronic handoffs, verbal handoffs. I think the worst thing that happened is probably the messaging handoff approach. I do think there's a lot of great value in picking up the phone and communicating directly. But for various different reasons, there can be processes where you're not necessarily giving report to the receiving person. You're giving report to a conduit, whether it's a triage officer or a in some places, it's you call the unit clerk and you give it. Is the handoff being given and received by the two key players who know the patient as well as they should? So handoff is a space that is an issue. Then there's the deviation of processes. And sometimes I think that really comes down to when we're sitting in a room and you're designing what's an ideal process, there can often be very disparate thoughts of the flow and the design. And so there's the idealistic design, but I encourage a pragmatic design. So thinking about a design of what, when and how to transition the patient through the system that is pragmatic over perfect. And this is where perfect is the enemy of good can often be a challenge. So I'd say that those two are the biggest buckets, the patient handoff and then the process of how the patient moves from the emergency department to their ICU bed.
One thing I was thinking also is that, I mean, these differences in perspective don't just come up here. They also come up all the time in the interface of specialties, right? We're dealing with consultants, surgeons, and so on. And in the same way, it's not usually a complete disagreement about what you're looking for or what you're trying to achieve. It's often a different take on priorities. You know, nephrology walks in and says, listen, we need to start dialysis now or something like that, whatever. Everyone's like, oh, maybe it was on the table. But they have a different take because of, you know, understanding of some evidence or physiology or whatever about what's most important. And just having that conversation to communicate to someone else who maybe had the same idea about what might happen or so on, but they didn't have the same sense of priority, it can make all the difference about getting on the same page. So maybe here too, you know, if let's say we're sitting in the ICU, we're hearing about a patient, and what's on our mind is like one thing. We have to get something done right now. There's some time-sensitive thing that's really going to make a difference to this patient's outcome. Tell them. Right? I mean, because it very well may be, they understand, of course, that's a thing. But on their big laundry list of other priorities for this patient, as well as many other patients, they hadn't pushed it to the top because they just hadn't thought about it in that way. But if that's how we're thinking about it in the ICU, it can be maybe as simple as that conversation. And, you know, maybe that's all that we need in some cases. And maybe it can go the other way as well if there's things that we can do to facilitate, you know, the patient's care down there. And sometimes I think this comes up when it's talking about workflows of who's going to take care of a patient who is, let's say, boarding in the ICU, which may be something worth talking about as well. But these are all things I think that have to, you know, minds have to come together to figure out what makes sense, both medically and then just practically in terms of workflows.
I think so, right? You know, sometimes I worry that in the house of medicine, there is still the perspective that emergency medicine is it's a young specialty. And so the feelings around knowledge gaps and assumptions of they don't want to do this or not interested in this, does that result in an implicit bias where the conversation is not necessarily rooted in the curiosity of what were you thinking, what are the challenges, and more of a telling, because I assume that I as an intensivist assume that you as the emergency physician don't know what you're doing.
Yeah, it's interesting because I feel like the same is often leveled against the ICU. I think critical care is a relatively young specialty, and I think, like Brandon said, there's a lot of specialists out there who sort of say, well, listen, you're not really an expert at anything except people who are real sick. And so it's funny hearing you. The thought I was struck with is how often we see, you know, two groups in society that are both sort of very similar, And kind of attacked by other people, but focus their energy on attacking them, each other, instead of being like, hey, we're really the same here. Like, we should stick together. Better communication, I think, is probably the biggest thing we can do. What else? Anything else we can do to sort of improve things?
I think in the lines of the communication, though, there's an opportunity to do real, like, deep listening, which ties into some of the communication. But the deep listening is not just at the individual level of the two specialists who might be interfacing on a single patient. The deep listening carries through into development of hospital and interdepartmental policies, procedures, guidelines, and having collaborative development of those. So it's not the ICU dictating what's ideal of patients' arrivals, or the emergency department dictating that this is the process. It really needs to be a collaborative. And even in that process, sometimes their collaboration can be viewed as just two groups of people coming to the table. But to have true collaboration in this space, it needs to start with the listening strategies and hearing the different roles, the challenges, the barriers, the facilitators, and negotiating then what comes to what really makes sense in the process. Because there are going to be times where, you know, to Brandon's point earlier, you communicate the priorities, but there are going to be times where there is not going to be agreement on that. So there is a negotiation process, because the phases of illness are just different. And so we can't have a one size fits all necessarily. So there is a lot of negotiation that goes into it, but it has to start from a place of deep listening.
Are there any tricks for having these conversations? I mean, I feel like for a lot of us, the only time we interface with ED is when you're dealing with a specific patient, but that doesn't leave a lot of opportunity for sort of growth. So, I mean, do you guys have any processes of reviewing cases or having some kind of regular meetings to, you know, between these departments to try to just work out the best way to go about things? I feel like that might be more productive than, you know, just dealing with individual problems as they come up. And you're probably well suited for this kind of thing, having both, you know, backgrounds. But
well, I don't know if it's like the both backgrounds, actually. I think it's more just a broader conversation around like interdisciplinary interaction. So this is where my role as a medical director, I think that kind of interdepartmental relationships come at your leadership level. And so there is a system in which you're engaging your leaders and interdepartmental and hospital leaders. So I've worked in different hospitals. Things that I've seen that work really well sometimes are collaborative grand round settings. So having ED, ICU, whether it's a case review session or grand rounds, like quarterly grand rounds, you can take turns inviting guests and having the two departments support. Having the leaders of the departments really, the interfacing has to start from the very top and work your way down. And to a lot of the points that have been already made, it's not just the two specialties. It's not just emergency medicine and critical care. I think there are a lot of similarities that lend themselves to work well. But if you're not a department of critical care in a hospital, then it's not. Are you the medical ICU living in pulmonary critical care? So then it becomes individual interfaces. So it's hard to create like broad terms, because hospitals are so different and the specialty distributions are different and the structure is different. But really thinking about starting from the top layers of leadership downwards, and is there an intentional multidisciplinary conversation approach and models that include case reviews, grand rounds, morbidity, mortality conferences, thinking about, or is there a forum for engagement for, you've got a new policy protocol guideline, is there opportunities for different councils or committees to ensure that they've reviewed and understood and given the opportunity to weigh in before it's finalized? And so there is, it's multi-layered intentionality, but I agree. I think it's not to be solved in the moment. it's more in the moment when there's conflict, it is recognize and escalate it. So it's a daytime leaders can address it. It's more often than not, the conflict escalates when there's this attempt to try and correct in the moment. But in the moment, it's two perspectives and the whole system-based narrative is not necessarily seen or heard. And so I very much when I work, if I have a conflict, I don't try and fix it in real time. I go about finishing my shift and then I deal with it on the next day or the following week in a process and a systematic approach.
I'm curious, this is probably worthy of its own episode altogether, but you know, we've talked a little bit about forming an EDICU, which is, I think, something a lot of people have some interest or at least curiosity in. But, you know, in the context of this conversation, it's an interesting idea because it's this overlap. You know, when we're talking about different ways of thinking and approaching patients, what do you see as the purpose or the goal of an EDICU? Is it meant to be more like the ED, or is it meant to be essentially an ICU that just physically happens to be downstairs or somewhere in between?
It depends on your needs. So the first thing to do when you are embarking on that interface is the needs assessment of what is the issue that is being tried to solve. So if there's long boarding, it's more of a, how can we deliver longitudinal critical care needs outside of the ICU? If it is volume of resuscitation and no resuscitationist, it might be more in that early phase. So really, it's a hard one to answer because all of them, the first thing I recommend is sitting down and looking at the needs assessment to try and understand what is the problem being solved. Because you could have EDICU interfaces, and whether they're geographic or personnel focused are the two like broad ways to think about it. But it could be a physical space, and the goal of the physical space could be to move your, because there's a boarding time of 24, 48, 72 hours, they need a place to create capacity in the emergency department. They need to be offloaded. It could be that there are a lot of transfers coming into the hospital, and so there are a lot of transfer requests and not enough beds. So the geographic spaces, it can have a variety of approaches. In the personnel focus space, you could have a ED-based console service. You could have an ICU-based console service. It comes down to what's your available resources and who's going to staff it and what's the comfort level. And so it takes a lot of thought, and you're right. We could do a whole different episode on just all the intricacies. But it really starts with the understanding what is the need and what is the gap that is being addressed or needs to be addressed, and then picking out the model that is going to address it. Not everybody can build a geographic space. Not everyone can build a personnel focus. So it takes a lot of the design phase is really important.
So not every EDICU is the same, and you should start with understanding of what you're trying to achieve, which should be more than just you think that would be cool and you want an EDICU.
100%. I think it's going to be cool, that's a highest likelihood to failure is going to be the, I think it's cool, we should build it.
Because you're not trying to achieve anything specific, so you're probably not going to achieve anything specific other than right. Spending some money and having a lot of meetings.
Well, it's interesting. It's interesting to hear you say to not try to solve problems in the moment, right? Because I think that makes a lot of sense. But so what do you do in the moment when you're having an issue besides just saying, I mean, because it's very easy for me to say, okay, I'm going to take a deep breath, and I know the ED's got a lot of stuff going on, and I'm going to try to have some empathy for them, and that's great. But I can't make anybody else think that. And if I suggest that, it probably comes across kind of condescending. If I go down and say, hey, listen, you know, we got some issues going on here, and I need you to see things from my point of view, it probably comes across pretty condescending. So what do you do in the moment to help solve these problems?
I wouldn't suggest going down and say, I'd like you to see it from my, I think the, yeah. This is coming down to conflict management, right? So There's two perspectives, and it's how skilled are we as individuals at resolving conflict? Not always great. And so hopefully there is a pre-existing escalation pathway to help with that. So I think the conversation starts with opening with curiosity and understanding and avoiding judgment. And at the end of that curiosity and understanding conversation, if there still continues to be different perspectives that are not in alignment, then there's got to be an escalation pathway. Are you calling your directors? Are you another directors calling the chief medical officers? The escalation pathway has to be predefined. The challenge is when the escalation pathway is not predefined and there's a lack of awareness. But the starting point is really opening with curiosity to understand why, help me understand what is this? Here's what I'm seeing. Here's what I'm thinking. How can we achieve this together? Most of the time, but there's got to be a little give and take in that conversation. But some of the time, the conflict remains. And so when the conflict remains, what is your local escalation process? And that's when, and so you got to know what that escalation process is. I tell my team, you've got to be adults and you've got to walk it out. You've got to walk through it. You've got to understand each other, try and resolve it. But if it's clear it's not resolving, they're calling the medical director on call. And I'm calling my counterparts. And if we can't resolve it, then it's escalating to my chief medical officer. But you've got to know what your escalation pathway is locally.
All right. So it sounds like most of the problems that we have could really be solved if everybody could just understand the other person's point of view and communicate well. So like every other problem in the world, right? So I don't know that there's a quick fix for this, but I think you're right. Having some predefined pathways and knowing what to do in the moment versus what not to do in the moment make a big difference. Anything else that you can think of on this topic that you think we need to discuss?
I think in general, in the house of medicine, we could take a step forward with empathy daily, and that would help out with our patients and the colleagues and such. I think we covered quite a bit, honestly. Personally, I look at, this is probably from my director role, I think there's a lot of things that systems and processes should tackle. And so the more robust your systems and processes are, whether it's escalation processes, identification of priorities, things like that, it solves a lot of conflict. And so when it comes down to the person interactions, systems and processes and organizational structure can go a long way in mitigating and avoiding some of the specialty-based conflicts.
I feel like, we've said this many times before, but it's just such a lesson that it can apply in so many situations. Whenever you're, looking at what someone else is doing and thinking that they must be nuts or evil or idiots, that's a pretty rare circumstance. So if you could instead have a little bit of curiosity and wonder why that is the case, why what they're doing must make sense within the context they're in, and then wonder what that context might be, then you're just going to be much better equipped to actually figure that out. I mean, if your goal is just to complain, then that's all you need to do. But if you would ever like to have some grasp for why the ED is doing what they're doing, or if you're in the ED, why the ICU is the way that they are, it has to start by truly wondering and being curious about it, not approaching it from a judgmental space where obviously you're all right and they are mad men or fools. But to say, if we're both rational people and we have this different take on this, I wonder why. Do they have other priorities, whether that's another patient or something else for this patient? Do they have a different background and training that's causing them to view this differently? do they have a whole different set of circumstances that I can't even grasp because it requires a whole lot of other assumptions that we'd have to have layers on layers here or whatever. You may not figure it out, but at least assuming that to start out is probably going to put us all in a more reasonable relationship than starting from the other angle.
I remember there are medical directors and leaders whose roles and responsibilities include kind of weeding out the knowledge gaps and the person issues. And so it doesn't have to be done in the moment. It really is let the directors deal with that.
Yeah. And I think this is a good example of something that it seems like this is a complicated problem, but it really just comes down to, like you say, just be curious. And I think we as humans often assume that when someone disagrees with us, it's because they're wrong. They're stupid. They're bad, whatever. Right. When the problem is that we may be both right. We're coming from different positions. And like you said, there's some reason, like you said, the example of someone who's just a horrible person or a lazy person or a stupid person are pretty rare.
Well, and like Namita said, you can probably trust the system to eventually weed those people.
To weed those out.
Criminals exist or like, you know, actual morons, but they're right, kind of minority.
Right. And so I think this just comes down to instead of assuming that, assume that there's some reason for their behavior and try to understand. And which is like so many things in life, it just comes down to put yourself in someone else's shoes and try to understand their point of view. All right. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up. Thank you to Namita Jayaprakash for joining us for this conversation. And we'll just remind folks that none of us are speaking officially on the record for any institution. These are just our thoughts, and this is just general medical education stuff and shouldn't be construed as any kind of specific medical advice. So thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.